Werbung.
Warum gibt es eigentlich Importarzneimittel? Ganz einfach, sie sind oft günstiger als die Präparate, die speziell für Deutschland produziert wurden. Und nicht nur das, Importarzneimittel können Lieferengpässe abfedern und sorgen so für mehr Versorgungssicherheit. Gleiche Wirksamkeit, gleiche Sicherheit zu einem besseren Preis. Mehr Infos unter cc-pharma.de und in den Shownotes.
Diesen Monat ist ja unser Spezialmonat bei der Dosis Wissen mit unserem Deep Dive zu Adipositas. Wir haben uns in 4 Folgen jetzt angeschaut, welche Gründe es für Adipositas gibt und was ich eigentlich tun müsste, gesellschaftlich, medizinisch, politisch, sehr, sehr viel. Und dazu haben wir aber auch mit einer Menge spannender Expertinnen und Experten gesprochen. Und für alle, die jetzt noch nicht genug von dem Thema haben, gibt es diese Woche, wie versprochen, die Interviews in voller Länge. Heute starten wir mit Professor Robert Lustig. Er ist Endokrinologe und hatte das mit der Kalorie ist eben nicht gleich die Kalorie gesagt, falls ihr euch erinnert. Dennis Ballwieser hat mit ihm gesprochen und sie haben sich getroffen in einem Museum in London. Also deshalb klingt das auch so ein bisschen anders hallig. Das Gespräch ist komplett auf Englisch. Wenn ihr wollt, könnt ihr es aber auf Deutsch nachlesen. Wir verlinken euch dazu unseren Apothekenumschau-Artikel in den Shownotes.
Eine Dosis Wissen, der Podcast für Health Professionals.
Und damit guten Morgen und willkommen bei Eine Dosis Wissen. Heute ist Montag, der 25. August 2025 und mein Name ist Laura Weisenburger. Von mir hört ihr heute aber gar nicht so viel, sondern eben mehr von Dennis und Robert Lustig. Und dabei jetzt viel Spaß.
Ein Podcast von Gesundheit hören. Und Apothekenumschau Pro.
Dr. Robert Lustig from California, San Francisco. Thank you for sitting in with me to talk about food, nutrition, health, and obesity.
And my pleasure, Dennis.
Thank you for being here. I was thinking, you grew up in New York City in the 1960s. So in your childhood, I imagine a lot of pizza, hamburgers, hot dogs, peanut butter and jelly sandwiches. Is there a comfort food from your childhood?
So, first of all, my mother worked 2 jobs. So I was a latchkey kid. Mm-hmm. And so I had to heat up a lot of Swanson TV dinners.
So those are the microwavable.
Oh, there was no such thing as a microwave.
Not then. In the 1960s, of course, yeah.
But, Salisbury steak or fried chicken, there was quite a bit of that. In terms of comfort food, probably, just the usual ice cream.
Ice cream, but, what kids like.
And my mother had a weight issue. She vacillated up and down, and we put a big sticker on the refrigerator, put brain in motion before moving mouth. I remember that from my childhood very well.
Okay, so 30 years ahead and to the Lustig household in San Francisco with your children.
Yeah.
What was comfort food in that household?
Well, prior to 2001, my wife and I probably ate out about 2 to 3 times a week because we both had jobs and, we're tired at the end of the day. And, we did what pretty much everyone in America did. once we had kids, we had to be a little bit more circumspect about that. And so we cut back significantly. And it was around that same time that I started realizing that the food was the problem. And so we started cooking at home pretty much routinely. We would eat out maybe once a month. Mm-hmm. And so my kids grew up in a very different household than I did, 40 years earlier.
Very different household than most American kids grow up, right?
Pretty much, yeah, at that point. In San Francisco, we have a good, food tradition. Mm-hmm. We understand what real food is in California and we have access to it. Mm-hmm. So I wouldn't say that it was that different for my kids than, say, other kids in the neighborhood. But It was certainly different from what I was used to.
How far does your déformation professionnelle go? Are you able to enjoy a food or a meal without thinking about nutrition?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. but I have to sort of, you know, give way to it.
So, you know? Yeah.
And it has to be a good meal. It has to be something special.
When you're traveling makes eating healthy and eating real food especially hard, and you're traveling
indeed.
A lot.
Indeed.
How do you deal with that?
You keep your eyes open. It's not easy at all. The best thing to do is focus on meat, fish, and vegetables. Mm-hmm. That's kind of what you can do. And of course, you know, restaurant food is usually heavy-handed starch, carbohydrate, and other, you know, and sweets. So you have to be very careful. One rule I have is when I'm on vacation, no dessert.
Okay. That's the easy one.
That's the easy one.
So you just said that prior to 2001, you led a pretty normal life food-wise in your household.
Yeah.
What made you switch your focus? You were almost 3 decades into your career before you took a turn to food and nutrition.
So I got into the obesity business late. I started my career in pediatric endocrinology in the mid-80s, looking at sex differentiation of the brain, how hormones affected the brain, why boys were boys and girls were girls from the neck up. But I had this idea about what might be the cause of obesity. Mm-hmm. And I didn't have the opportunity initially to be able to act on it until I moved to St. Jude Children's Research Hospital in Memphis, Tennessee in 1995. And at that point, I was presented with a cadre of about 40 children who had had brain tumors, who survived their tumor due to either the surgery or the radiation or the chemotherapy, only to become massively obese. Mm-hmm. And so I was charged with trying to help these children.
Obesity-wise. That was the question posed at you.
And these were kids who were 350, 400 pounds, enormous. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they had lost all interest in life. They basically sat on the couch, ate Doritos, and slept. And the parents would come to me complaining, saying, "This is double jeopardy. My kids survived the tumor only to succumb to the therapy." And I had to do something about it. As a neuroendocrinologist, I knew there was a medical literature about lesioning the area of the brain that controls energy balance called the hypothalamus. And I knew that you could stop the obesity from that lesioning by cutting the nerve that leads from the brain to the pancreas called the vagus nerve. Now, vagotomy would stop that process, but I'm not a surgeon. And I had to do something that would do the same thing as
without
that vagotomy.
Surgery.
Without a surgery. And it turned out there was a drug that could limit insulin release from the pancreas. And so we tried that in these children. And lo and behold, they started losing weight. But they didn't just lose weight. That was amazing enough. Because these were kids who basically gained weight on 500 calories a day. It had been shown 30 years prior that, you know, these kids would rather store it than burn it.
So the metabolism completely changed.
Exactly.
Burning the calories was not an option. Storing everything was what the body did.
Right. And we had learned in the meantime about this hormone that your fat cells make that goes to your brain called leptin. That was discovered in 1994. And so I hypothesized that these kids could not see their leptin because that area of the brain was damaged. So the question is, what is downstream of leptin? And it turns out that vagus nerve was downstream of leptin. So could I impact on the output of that vagus nerve? Well, we gave this drug that suppressed insulin. And sure enough, the patients lost weight. But more importantly, they started exercising spontaneously.
Without you intervening?
I didn't tell them to do anything. They just did. And the first patient, it was remarkable. So this was patient number one, a patient with pineal germinoma, 220 pounds, 100 kilos. And I told the mother, look, I've never used this drug before. I know what it does, but this is new for me. I want to hear from you in a week. She calls me up in 5 days, screaming on the phone. Dr. Lustig, something's happening. Oh my God, you know, like adverse event, you know, shut down the study, go to jail. I'm waiting for the other shoe to drop. What happened? She says, well, normally we would go to Taco Bell and she would eat 5 tacos and an enchilito and she'd still be hungry. We just went to Taco Bell and she ate 2 tacos and she was full. And she just vacuumed the house.
So eating changed and?
Exercise changed.
Exercise changed.
Both. And then we did 8 patients and the same thing happened. I said, this is really remarkable. So we did a double-blind placebo-controlled trial in a new set of patients. Mm-hmm. And we built in a quality of life questionnaire with physical activity as part of it. Mm-hmm. And sure enough, when we did the analysis on this double-blind placebo-controlled trial, yes, the weight went down, but the physical activity went up. And so what this showed me was that the two behaviors that we associate with obesity, the gluttony and the sloth, are actually biochemically determined. And that really changed the way I viewed the entire question of obesity, and it also changed how I treated my patients. I turned my obesity clinic into an insulin reduction clinic. Mm-hmm. Get the insulin down any way you can, because insulin is driving energy into fat cells.
But help me out here, because I am a massively obese male in his 40s.
Yeah.
I didn't have a brain tumor.
Nope.
I.
Me too. Hey, you look, you know, it's not like I'm you know.
What is happening inside my brain that makes me obese? I grew obese as a kid.
Yeah.
In my teenage years. What happened there without the brain tumor?
So there are two different insulin problems. One is called insulin hypersecretion, and that's the one that this drug treats, this hypothalamic obesity problem. And by the way, there are 20% of normal obese adults have this same problem and also respond to this drug the same way.
Without being obese.
Well, they're obese,
Without a brain tumor, yeah.
But that means that 80% don't respond and don't get better.
Right.
And so the question is, what's going on with the 80%? Because that's where the real, quote, money is.
Yeah.
What I can say is that those patients are not insulin hypersecretors. They're not releasing too much insulin from the pancreas. Those patients are insulin resistant. Insulin resistant. Now, what is that? So when you're insulin resistant, your pancreas makes insulin, but then your liver does not respond to it very well. And so your pancreas has to make more to make the liver do its job. And that raises insulin levels all over the body. And because the fat cell is still insulin sensitive, that high insulin drives energy into fat. So the only way to fix that problem is to fix the problem at the level of the liver. So then you have to know, okay, what's going on at the level of the liver? Well, we have this new disease that started being recognized in the early 1990s, which we called non-alcoholic fatty liver disease, or NAFLD, which now has a new name called MASLD, metabolic-associated steatotic liver disease. I hate that name.
And what it is for patients is your doctor does an ultrasound of your liver and tells you there's fat in your liver that doesn't belong there.
That's right. Exactly right. And what that fat is doing is it's interfering with the ability of insulin to do its job.
So
you have to clear the fat.
That makes me more obese faster because my liver doesn't do its job.
Correct.
Okay.
So you have to attack the liver where the problem is. So then the question became, okay, if that's the case, what's the cause of the liver fat and how do we get rid of it? And that's when, shall we say, the you-know-what hit the fan.
Mm-hmm.
In 2006, I was asked by the National Institutes of Health to give a talk at their 100th anniversary of the National Institute of Environmental Health Sciences. Mm-hmm. And the question posed to me was, what did I think was the most important environmental contributor to the obesity epidemic?
What did you say?
Well, I thought a lot about it. And they thought I was going to come up with some chemical like bisphenol A or PFAS, mm-hmm. Things that definitely are obesogenic.
And they're not main ingredients of our food, right?
Exactly. They're there, but yeah. They weren't, shall we say, the primary driver. And they weren't there at the beginning of the obesity epidemic. They came in sort of later. Mm-hmm. And so I sat down and I said, all right, look, I'm a pediatrician. Children today get two diseases they never got before. Type 2 diabetes and fatty liver disease. Mm-hmm.
Early in their life.
Early in their life, at age 5. Mm-hmm. This is not normal, okay? They are the canaries in the coal mine. Mm-hmm. They are being exposed to something mm-hmm. now that they weren't before that is driving this phenomenon. And type 2 diabetes and fatty liver disease are the manifestations of it, and obesity comes along with it. That I was sure of. The question was, what is that something? Mm-hmm. So, those two diseases, type 2 diabetes and fatty liver disease, they used to be, when I entered medical school, they used to be the diseases of alcohol. Mm-hmm. But kids don't drink alcohol. Mm-hmm. At least 5-year-olds don't.
No.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
So, I opened up my biochemistry textbook from 1974, and I opened it to the alcohol page. And I looked at the metabolism of alcohol, and I said, yeah, okay, I remember that. Mm-hmm. And then I turned the page, and there was this other molecule called fructose, mm-hmm. which is the sweet molecule in sugar, in table sugar. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So table sugar, sucrose, is two molecules, one glucose.
And the other fructose.
And the other fructose. Mm-hmm. Now, glucose is not very sweet. Mm-hmm. Glucose is what's in molasses. Mm-hmm. You don't see people chugging molasses.
No.
Yeah, it might be good in a cookie, but not too much. Okay, corn syrup.
Yeah.
Tate and Lyle's corn mm-hmm. syrup. Mm-hmm. You don't see people abusing that, mm-hmm. but fructose is very sweet, mm-hmm. and people do abuse that.
And then we are at high fructose corn syrup.
And now we have high fructose corn syrup on top of that. Mm-hmm. Not so much in Europe, a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
Much more in America, Japan, Canada, a few other places. Bottom line, that fructose molecule is metabolized in the liver just like alcohol. Does the same thing and causes the same diseases as alcohol, including type 2 diabetes and fatty liver disease. Mm-hmm. And so I put this talk together for the mm-hmm. NIH mm-hmm. saying, I think that the driver of the metabolic syndrome, obesity, fatty liver disease epidemic is the consumption of sugar, especially in youth.
But wasn't it a little bit late in the late 20th century to... So that the disease showed itself very late because fructose and sugar has been introduced into our food way earlier than that.
Sure. And in fact, we've seen in the onset of chronic metabolic diseases go slowly initially for just that reason. Example, the first documentation of a change in metabolic status in the human population mm-hmm. due to environmental issues was 1924.
What happened in 1924?
Haven Emerson, Commissioner of Health of New York City, published a paper showing a 7-fold increase in the incidence of diabetes in the New York City population.
That was grown-ups, not children.
Right, in grown-ups. Mm-hmm. The point was, If you compare the increase in type 2 diabetes in the general population and the increase in sugar consumption, they parallel each other beautifully. And of course, things just got worse from there.
And then something must have happened policy-wise and in terms of how we use sugar in producing our food, right?
No, not really. All that happened was that in the 1930s in America, we had two phenomena go on at the same time. We had the Depression and we had the Dust Bowl. So, first of all, food became inordinately expensive. And second of all, we had a destitute population in the American Southwest. And we had to get food from the Midwest and the Northeast, where it was being produced, down to the American Southwest, where it could be consumed. The problem is, if you took real food and put them on railroad cars and shipped them, by the time they would arrive there, it would go rancid. So that's when processing started. That's when we started turning wheat into, you know, 10-pound bags of flour and shipping them by railroad car and baking it up on site. And look, we solved a, you know, catastrophe, a, you know, nutritional catastrophe based on this concept of processing. And then came World War II, and we needed it yet again. And, you know, the K ration, you know, 12,000 calories in a little tin box that soldiers could carry into battle. You couldn't do that without food processing. So food processing became a matter of survival for the United States all the way through World War II. And so various policies that encouraged food processing were placed, you know, into the American zeitgeist at that
point. And that changed how food was being made after World War II as well.
Well, so after World War II, we didn't need those policies, but the food industry had figured out they can make money at this. So they doubled down. And so it only got worse. And so we ended up, you know, generating processed food across the board. And then it started entering, you know, grocery stores and became sort of diet staples. And that's when breakfast cereal started appearing on shelves. And, you know, that, you know, sort of hit in the mid 60s. And then, of course, we had the advent of high fructose corn syrup in 1975, which wasn't added to the food supply until really 1980. And the reason was because Hurricane Allen destroyed the entire Caribbean sugar crop. And so America decided we needed a homegrown sweetener. And so that's when high fructose corn syrup sort of took over.
And that has never gone away.
And it's never gone away.
Still here and
here we
still put in the processed food.
And here we are.
But the learned perception, which I learned in medical school as well, and which is basically how everybody sees obese people, is it's a lifestyle choice. You are a sedentary person. You're lacking the willpower to eat differently and to exercise more. And you're saying that is not the point.
That is, it's not even true. Okay? It's not even true. And
this is important for obese people, I think.
Oh, absolutely.
Put out there.
Absolutely. And this is the reason I wrote my first book, Fat Chance, because obese people needed to understand it's not their fault. The behavior is really biochemistry. I can take anyone and make them eat more if I make them insulin resistant. If I raise their insulin in any way, shape, or form, they will eat more. If I take a thin person and stick an IV in and inject them with insulin, they will eat more. So the question is, what's causing the increase in insulin? Well, the answer is this phenomenon, hepatic or liver insulin resistance. So how do you clear that? How do you fix that? And the answer is, if you get the fat out of the liver, you become insulin sensitive, and then you don't want to eat more.
How do you get the fat out of the liver?
Ah. For that, you need to come to my clinic and pay some money. No, I'm only kidding. The fact is that the primary driver of the insulin resistance is the fat in the liver, and the primary driver of the fat in the liver is the sugar in the diet.
Now, so you take the sugar out of the diet?
Take the sugar out of the diet, and the fat goes away.
Problem
and we
fixed.
Proved it. Well, sort of.
How do I do it in the supermarket? Seems to be a problem there.
Indeed. So we did a study at UCSF, 43 children out of our obesity clinic, Latino and African American, all with metabolic syndrome, all high sugar consumers. And what we did was we studied them on their home diet. And then for the next 9 days, we catered their meals. Mm-hmm. No added sugar. We took the percent calories as added sugar from 28% of their calories down to 10% of their calories.
So you capped the calories that the children were fed?
We gave them the same number that they were eating all along. Because the goal here was not weight loss. The goal was to actually maintain their weight. Because if the patients lost weight, the naysayers, the critics, would say, well, of course the kids got better. They lost weight. We needed them to stay the same weight or even gain weight for that matter.
But change the metabolism.
But change the composition of the diet. So we took their percent calories as added sugar from 28 down to 10%. Now, if you do that, you're going to lose 335 to 400 calories per day out of the diet. And if you do that for 10 days, you might lose weight. We didn't want them to lose weight, so we had to give them more food. And we had to replace those 335 to 400 calories with something that was equicaloric. That was the same number of calories, just not sugar. We gave them starch.
Starch, okay. So not sweet?
Not sweet. So in other words, in the vernacular, we took the pastries out, we put the bagels in. We took the sweetened yogurt out, we put the baked potato chips in. We took the chicken teriyaki out, we put the turkey hot dogs in. So we didn't give them good food. We gave them crappy food. We gave them processed food. Okay, we gave them kid food, so food kids would eat.
It is possible with processed food to eat healthier than the human
way. Oh, absolutely. Yes. And we'll talk about that in a little bit as to what the food industry could do to fix this problem, just to that point. All right. In any case, these kids ate the same number of calories because they did not lose weight for 10 days. And then we studied them again 10 days later. Every aspect of their metabolic health got better. Their blood glucose went down by 5 points. Their blood pressure went down by 5 points. They had a lactate level at baseline. And you as a physician know that if you have a lactate level at baseline, you're sick. Okay? Because that means your mitochondria are not working. Okay? So you were either post-exercise or you have a mitochondrial encephalomyopathy, which is like really bad for you, or you have cancer.
We have to explain, I think, what mitochondria are doing for our bodies.
Indeed. We will get there. Bottom line, every aspect of their metabolic health improved. And the reason was because we took the offending agent out of their diet. And even though they ate the same number of calories, even though they didn't lose weight, they became metabolically healthier. Every aspect of their metabolism, their lipids got better. And guess what? Their fatty liver disappeared.
So what this means in terms of me standing in the supermarket aisle is I have to exchange foods that are high in fructose with either processed or non-processed foods that are low in fructose. Is it as simple as that?
Well, that's a good start. I'm not going to tell you it's that simple because everyone's different, okay? And there are other reasons for fatty liver, like alcohol, okay? But the fact of the matter is, that's where it starts. Our food has basically been contaminated by the added sugar that the food industry has put into it. Now, if you think that sugar is just calories, then you would say, well, why sugar? Maybe it's fat. Or maybe it's protein, or maybe it's something else. You know, it's just the amount you eat. If you believe that every calorie is the same, that a calorie is a calorie. I think that my work and the reason I have written books and the reason I have published papers and the reason I'm sitting with you right now discussing this is because I think I've made it painfully obvious that a calorie is not a calorie.
What does it mean for me as an eating human being?
Well, the food industry would have you believe that all calories are the same.
They're saying I'm responsible for the mix of my food.
And indeed, if a calorie were a calorie, that would be true, if that were the case. And they want you to believe that because if a calorie is a calorie, then there is no individual food that is problematic, which gives them license to be able to purvey anything they want, and it becomes your personal responsibility to watch your own diet. This assuages their culpability for the composition of the food that they provide on the shelf. If a calorie were a calorie. But it's not.
And what does that mean?
Okay. Let's talk about what a calorie is first. So a calorie is not a unit of biology. It is a unit of physics.
Yeah.
That's right. It is how much energy do you have to apply to 1 gram of water to raise the temperature 1 degree centigrade? That's a calorie. Okay. A unit of physics. Now, in 1902, a scientist by the name of Wilbur Atwater discovered that if you place fat in a bomb calorimeter and blow it up to smithereens, it will release energy and it will release 9 calories per gram of fat. If you put protein into the bomb calorimeter and you explode it to smithereens, it will release 4 calories per gram of protein. And for carbohydrate, 4 calories per gram of carbohydrate.
Carbohydrate would be sugar.
Sugar would be within carbohydrate, yes. So based on that experiment, the assumption was, and Atwater's assumption, and everybody's assumption since that time, is that because fat is more energy dense, therefore fat must be more fattening.
That brought the fat-reduced yogurts?
Yes, absolutely. The point is that that assumption has never been documented. That has never been proven. Not once. Never. In fact, we now have data to show that that was a big lie.
But a lot of dietary recommendations are still based on that assumption, right?
To this day, by many dietetic associations around the country, around the world, still believe that. And the question is, why do they believe that? And the reason is because if you blow it up in a bomb calorimeter, you can do the math on the calories.
What happens if you blow it up in the human body?
Ah, you don't blow it up in the human body. You metabolize it in these little organelles inside each of your cells called mitochondria.
There they are again.
And mitochondria are not bomb calorimeters.
So indeed, they use the energy in a different way.
So calories generate heat. Mitochondria generate a chemical called ATP, adenosine triphosphate.
That's the energy that we are burning, right?
The energy of our cells. Yeah. It is essential. It is the goal of cells to basically produce the ATP they need to survive, thrive, and do their job. And without ATP, they're dead. And so are you. Just that simple. The question is, does ATP generation correlate with calories? And the answer is not even close. They are not the same. Example. If you take a certain amount of energy and explode it in a bomb calorimeter, you take that same amount of energy and put it in cells that have mitochondria, 40% of the energy will go off as heat from the cells. 60% will be turned into ATP, as opposed to 100%, which will be generated as heat in the bomb calorimeter. So those are not the same. Okay. On the other hand, if you change what those food is in terms of its matrix, like for instance, adding fiber, like real food, turns out you didn't absorb 25 to 30% of those calories. They never even made it into your bloodstream. They stayed in your intestine and the microbiome chewed it up.
Took care of it.
And so you didn't even get it, even though they passed your lips, even though they registered as a calorie here at your lips, at your intestine, they didn't.
But the nutrition facts on my supermarket label tell me different.
Well, indeed, and that's part of the problem. So calories are not calories if they came with fiber. Calories are not calories if they are protein, because protein getting converted to energy, actually you have to invest energy to be able to turn that protein into energy. So there's a net loss of calories.
So that's why nuts, for example, are better for you to eat as a snack than anything else, right?
Absolutely. Yes.
Because they're high in protein and you metabolize only a certain percentage of it.
And they're even high in fat, but they're still better for you and they don't generate the insulin response that a carbohydrate does. And it's that insulin response that actually drives the energy into fat. And what we've learned is that because of that leptin problem that we talked about at the beginning, okay, that driving of energy into that fat cell should generate a leptin response, but if your brain can't see it because of the high insulin, and insulin blocks leptin signaling at the brain, then your brain doesn't know you ate, and so you eat more. So insulin is the bad guy in the story, both in terms of driving energy into fat peripherally to drive the weight gain, and also to block the effect of leptin at the brain in order to keep you eating. So if you look from the outside, it looks like gluttony and sloth because you're not burning the energy and you're eating more. But that's the result of the biochemical process of the leptin resistance, which was actually because of the insulin.
So that makes me think about me standing in the supermarket aisle again, because now my psychology kicks in.
Right.
I know all that. I consider myself a little bit educated on the topic.
Well, you better be, your physician.
Why am I having such a hard time to change my habits?
Yes. So number one, there's this thing called ultra-processed food addiction.
Okay.
About 20% of the population has it. It's actually easy to determine who's who. You just ask one question. Say, oh, I have a horrible sweet tooth. That's sugar addiction till proven otherwise. And sugar addiction and ultra-processed food addiction are basically the same thing, because that's where the sugar is in the ultra-processed food. Because if the sugar weren't in the ultra-processed food, you wouldn't eat it.
Okay?
Just that simple. Why are some people addicted and some people are not addicted? We do not know. Why are some people addicted to alcohol and others are not? Why are some people addicted to nicotine and others are not? We don't know. To this day, we have looked for the genetics of addiction and have not found it.
Okay.
So this is a question mark, and I'm not going to tell you I know the answer to that. But I do know that there is a phenomenon called ultra-processed food addiction, of which sugar is the primary driver, and we have the data to demonstrate that. We are actually petitioning the World Health Organization to create a new diagnosis for ultra-processed food addiction right now.
What would we have to change in order to change this addiction in the patients?
Right. It'd have to change the food.
How would we do that?
The food industry has to come along, and the problem is they don't want to come along because the sugar is their gravy train. It's their hook. It's the thing that changed food companies' annual profit margin from 1% per year to 5% per year because of the addition of sugar that started in the early 80s and has continued to the present day.
Would things like the UK sugar tax work if they were applied in more countries?
Yes. So we have data now to demonstrate that there are, first of all, 28 countries that have instituted a sugar tax, which is the low-hanging fruit in terms of regulation. I'm actually giving a talk on this here in London next week on exactly this topic.
So Great Britain is leading by example.
Yes, definitely. and Mexico and several other countries. In America, six cities have adopted a soda tax.
Local sugar tax.
Local soda tax. Soda tax, not sugar tax. Yeah. San Francisco being one of them. And so we actually have the five-year data on whether or not, not only did it change consumption, but did it change health? And the answer is absolutely it did in both cases. It reduced consumption and it improved health. In fact, since the advent of the San Francisco soda tax, which was instituted in 2018, gestational diabetes mellitus, which is now a huge problem, 14% of all pregnancies.
So in the mothers, the diabetes, while they're being pregnant.
While they're being pregnant, okay, has been reduced by 77% since the advent of the San Francisco soda tax, as an example. So we have the data to demonstrate both changes in consumption and changes in efficacy. And this makes perfect sense because this actually conforms to the iron law of public health, which states that reducing availability of an offending agent will reduce consumption, which will reduce health harms. So a soda tax is a way, not the only way, but a way to basically alter societal behavior on the basis of price. There are other ways too, but ultimately the concept that we have to have some sort of societal intervention to go along with the personal intervention has been necessary for all addictive substances. Think about what we have that's addictive. Tobacco. We have personal intervention. We have societal intervention. Okay. Rehab laws. Okay. For alcohol, we have personal intervention. We have societal intervention. Opioids. We have personal intervention. We have societal intervention. Ultra-processed food is addictive in the same way. It's toxic and addictive. It's ubiquitous, and it has negative impacts on society. It meets all the criteria for societal intervention. Yet, we have nothing for it other than the few places that have instituted a sugar tax.
Understood. So, there is a new player in town for a few years now. People turn to it. It's a new class of medication.
Indeed.
The GLP-1 agonists.
Right.
What are you thinking about those class of drugs? Because for the first time, really, for obesity, there seems to be a medical solution on the horizon.
I wouldn't call it a solution. I would call it a Band-Aid.
Good. But because it's not fixing...
It's not fixing the problem.
At the core.
Yeah, it's not fixing the problem. It's Band-Aiding the problem. And let me explain why and how. So I wear three hats. Okay? I wear the clinician hat, I wear the scientist hat, and I wear the public health advocate slash policy wonk hat. Okay? Let me take each of those in turn. When I wear my clinician hat, I'm glad they're here because they work. And I'm not saying they don't work. Okay? Semaglutide, 16% mean weight loss. Tirzepatide, 20% mean weight loss. That is not chicken feed. That's real. Okay? And so there are patients who have failed virtually every other modality, who have comorbidities like type 2 diabetes, heart disease, et cetera, and they need these or they will die.
So it's an option for them to take them?
Absolutely, and I am for that.
Okay.
So I am not against these medications. New hat, my scientist hat. Why do these medications work? Well, they work in two places. First place they work is here at the brain. And what they seem to do is reduce the noise, the food noise, the addiction. That food noise is the addiction.
You're treating the addiction of the patient.
That's right. And so it's making it much easier for people to be able to walk away from that plate of ice cream or that, chocolate cake.
So it makes it easier to have the right choice made in the supermarket aisle.
Indeed. Okay. And that sounds very good. Having said that, the way it's working is by reducing the reward signal. Whenever you reduce the reward signal, you're changing people's internal emotions. Mm-hmm. You are basically changing their relationship to the world. You are inducing a form of depression.
So it's basically a psychiatric drug.
To some extent. And the psychiatrists are starting to use it as such. And they're starting to use it for all forms of addiction, not just food addiction, but in fact, alcohol addiction, opioid addiction. And so this may end up being very, very important as a modality for trying to undo addiction. The problem is we've seen this movie before. In 2006, there was a drug available in Europe, never in America, in Europe, called Romanabant, okay, trade name Acomplia.
Yeah.
And this was an endocannabinoid antagonist. This was the anti-marijuana drug.
People
this was
depressed.
The anti-munchies drug. Yeah, as soon as the drug was approved, there were 21 suicides within 2 months, and Sanofi had to pull the drug from the market.
But we are not seeing that effect and that manifestation right now with the GLP-1 agonists, right?
We're seeing the change in mood. We are not seeing suicides.
Yeah, yeah.
So we have to monitor this.
But you have to be careful and you have to take that into account.
Absolutely.
And it has to be monitored by physicians who know what they're doing.
Exactly right.
And there seems to be a bit of a problem there.
Yes.
In some countries, at least.
Well, some places are compounding and we don't even know what they're taking. And yes, they're, non-physician providers that are, dispensing this. It's highly problematic, to say the least. So that's one place it works. The second place it works is on the GI tract, on the intestine, and the stomach in particular. And what it does is it delays a gastric emptying, delays the stomach from moving the food through to the intestine. And that's why you don't want to eat, because your stomach's still full. Right. All right. Well, that is a good reason to not want to eat, but unfortunately, it's also a good reason for getting bloating and distension and vomiting and pancreatitis, and most importantly, gastroparesis. Stomach turns to stone. Okay. Now, if you get pancreatitis or gastroparesis, you're not going to be very happy.
Yeah, absolutely.
And you're going to have a whole lot of side effects. And some of those are going to land you in the hospital. And there have already been a few deaths from gastroparesis. And there is actually a class action lawsuit in America over gastroparesis because it's not even on the label that this can occur. 3.4% of all patients who take a GLP-1 agonist end up with gastroparesis. This is a problem. So that's a big issue. In addition, when you look at the weight loss that occurs, and it's not insignificant, it's real, it turns out to be equal amounts fat and muscle. Now, you want to lose the fat, but you don't want to lose the muscle. Losing muscle actually means earlier demise. Muscle's important for longevity.
Absolutely.
And if you're losing equal amounts of fat and muscle, that's not necessarily in your best interest. Do you know something else that causes equal amounts of loss of fat and muscle? Starvation. And that's how it works. You're starving.
Yeah.
This is not good.
Okay.
All right. And also, only 1/3 of patients who take these drugs actually respond.
Have the effect.
So the companies actually report out only the responders, not the intent to treat. And that's a problem. And
always a problem.
1/3 of the patients who go on them within a year are not on them anymore, and they gain all their weight back plus some.
That's the main question. What happens if I have to stop taking it because it's all out-of-pocket expense for all the patients?
Exactly. And all the weight comes rushing back because you haven't solved the problem. So you've band-aided the
problem. That's not a long time.
It's not a long-term solution.
That societies might...
Right. And it only keeps working as long as you keep taking it, which is great for the company, but not great for you.
So,
and then finally, let me put my last hat on.
The policy hat.
The policy hat. Now, these drugs do work. 16% weight loss for semaglutide, 20% for tirzepatide. That's not small. It's real. Okay? In America, if everyone in America who qualified for GLP-1 analog got it, That would be 2.1 trillion US dollars to the healthcare system. Right now, our healthcare system is 4.1 trillion. That would be a 50% surcharge over what we're currently paying. And we can't afford that because Medicare will be broke by the year 2029, as it is, notwithstanding this addition. Conversely, and that's for a 16 to 20% weight loss. Conversely, if we just got added sugar in our diet down to rational USDA guidelines of 12...
By changing policy for food manufacturing.
Correct. By getting sugar consumption down to 12 teaspoons of added sugar per day, which is still plenty, but about half as much as we're currently consuming, we would see a 29% weight loss. So better weight loss and save $3.0 trillion with no side effects. So which makes more sense to you?
That brings us to the, I think, biggest elephant in the room. We are always talking about the individual and what the individual could do or should do or has to do.
Right.
We're not talking about what society needs to do with the environment around the person in order to make it possible.
Well, the reason for that is because the food industry doesn't want to engage in that discussion because that's bad for them. But it doesn't have to be. They want you to believe a calorie is a calorie because then what's different about their food than anybody else's food? So they assuage their culpability. So they are married, wedded to the notion that a calorie is a calorie, except a calorie is not a calorie. And it matters what you consume because not all calories are equal. But the minute you agree to that, the minute you say yes to that, that means you have to start reformulating policy. And they don't want to do that because this is their gravy train. This is where they get on in terms of their profits.
But
it doesn't have to be.
And this
it doesn't
seems
have to be.
Be the fight politicians and physicians have to pick, right?
Well, let me tell you about a little experiment that's going on in the Middle East. This is a company, a ultra-processed food company. It's like the Nestle of the Middle East. Kuwaiti Danish Dairy Company, KDD. They make flavored milks, they make frozen yogurt, they make ice cream, they make
sweet
biscuits,
stuff.
Confectionery, tomato sauce, all high sugar containing
food.
And all processed. Okay? Because you can't grow any food in Kuwait. And you can't raise any cows in Kuwait. So all of this is manufactured, ultra processed from ingredients that are imported from elsewhere. Kuwait has an 18% diabetes rate and an 80% obesity rate. The chief executive officer and founder of the company, Sir Mohammed Jafar, is a Kuwaiti national, but actually raised in the UK, knighted Sir Mohammed. How many Sir Mohammeds you know?
Not many.
Came to me in 2020 during the pandemic and said, we understand that we are part of the problem. We want to be part of the solution. Can you help us re-engineer our entire portfolio to be metabolically healthy?
Is it possible?
It is not only possible, they are already doing it. It's taken 5 years, 3 years of analysis and 2 years of implementation, but they have turned over 10% of their portfolio. And we have tested those products to actually demonstrate their metabolic health. And so these are on the market in Kuwait today. Now, the reason we could do that is because KDD is not, you know, it's privately held. The only owners are Sir Mohammed and his sister.
So he can decide or they can decide.
They can take the long view. Now, the problem is most other food companies are not privately held.
They have quarterly reports.
And stakeholders and stockholders that have to be placated. And it's all about the profit. It's all about the next quarter's profit. If that's your goal, you can never fix the problem. So we need government to help intervene at this level to be able to get companies all on board together. And this can be done. It was done right here in the UK for salt back in 2003. the Blair government convened the entire UK food establishment in a secret meeting in 2003 and said, hypertension and stroke are up 40% in the UK because of the sodium content of ultra-processed food. So everyone in this room is going to play by the same rules, and everyone is going to reduce the sodium content of each one of their products by 10% per year over a course of 3 years to a reduction of 30%. And most importantly, we are going to watch, we're going to regulate, everyone will play on the same playing field so that there's no competitive disadvantage. And most importantly, we're not going to tell the public.
Which might be a problem if you're not going to tell the public what you're doing, right?
Well, they did it. And guess what?
It worked?
It worked. And hypertension and stroke in the UK fell by 40%. And a paper in the British Medical Journal in 2011 documented the change. So public health intervention is doable.
But the rationale being always, if everybody has to do it, there's only one loser. And the one picture being the salt industry and the other picture being the sugar industry, but all the other companies would still benefit from what they are selling.
Indeed.
Yeah.
And the fact of the matter is the sugar industry knows because they're getting out of it. Look at Tate and Lyle. Mm-hmm. They know they've got a problem.
It seems to be a little bit like we used to talk about tobacco and smoking.
Yes.
Are we seeing the same movie playing out here?
Absolutely. It's the same thing all over again. And it makes sense that that would be the case.
But we're still having a hard time. You might think we should have learned something from the tobacco discussions.
Well, except that the tobacco industry controlled the food industry. Look at Philip Morris, you know, and Altria. You know, they owned, Kraft and General Foods, and R.J. Reynolds owned Nabisco, and they brought their addictive portfolio to the food industry back in the 1980s to 2000s, and it hasn't been undone. So, in fact, the food industry knows what it's doing.
So here's my last question. What gives you hope for the next years, nutrition-wise?
So, a very good question. What gives me hope is that the public is starting to recognize the problem. 3 out of 4 people in America today want to cut their sugar consumption. Mm-hmm. Okay. And this is not my data. This is actually generated by the food industry itself. Okay. And we're seeing the food industry moving toward non-nutritive sweeteners such as allulose or tagatose or stevia or erythritol or monk fruit, et cetera. They're trying to get away from what, you know, so, you know, what brung them, as it were, number one. Number two, there's a market now for better food, mm-hmm. Okay? And, you know, we have a nonprofit, for instance, in the Bay Area that is getting real food into K-12 in public schools in the United States.
So where children have to eat.
Exactly. So this is what gives me hope, is that we can change the construct. And this is not crazy. We've done this before. Think of it this way, Dennis. In the last 30 years, we have seen 4 cultural tectonic shifts around the world. And here are the 4. Mm-hmm. Bicycle helmets and seatbelts. Mm-hmm. Smoking in public places. Mm-hmm. Drunk driving.
Yeah.
Condoms in bathrooms. Mm-hmm. 4 cultural tectonic shifts. Okay. 30 years ago, if a legislator stood up in a state house or, you know, Congress or Parliament or the Duma or anywhere else in the world, okay, and proposed legislation for any one of those 4, it had gotten laughed right out of town. Nanny state, liberty interest, get out of my kitchen, get out of my bathroom, get out of my car. Mm-hmm. Today, they're all facts of life. Mm-hmm. We have new things to bellyache about, mm-hmm. like vaccines, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. but those 4 are settled science. No one's bellyaching about any of those. And if you, as a father, pull your car out of the driveway and you haven't buckled your seatbelt, your kids will scream at you.
Yeah.
They will tell you. How'd that happen? And why did it take 30 years?
Yeah.
We taught the children. The children grew up and they voted.
Mm-hmm.
And the naysayers are dead. That's why this is a generational shift. And all of these cultural tectonic shifts are generational. Yeah. And this is why. We're seeing this change in food now.
Okay.
Okay. We're about, I would say, 10 years into it. So it's coming. It's unstoppable. And this also gives me hope.
Thank you so very much for your insights, your thoughts, and your personal history with food and nutrition. And thanks for being here with us, Dr. Robert Lustig.
My pleasure.
Thank you.
Das war das komplette Gespräch. Wie schon gesagt, in den Shownotes verlinken wir euch nochmal den Artikel auf Deutsch dazu, wenn ihr da nochmal Dinge nachlesen möchtet. Morgen geht es weiter mit dem Interview mit Professorin Marion Nessel. Und ab dem 1.9., da kommt dann wieder ganz normal unser werktägliches Gesundheitsupdate in kompakten 10 Minuten. Bis dann!
Podcast von Gesundheit hören und Apotheken Umschau Pro.